All right. Good evening, everyone. Welcome. So I'd like to offer a second talk on these worldly winds and take it a little different direction. Because these worldly winds, as we talked about 2 weeks ago, you know, these eight vicissitudes of gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute, praise and blame. There's a pain side and there's also the pleasure side. So we have both these elements that are given to us as human beings. And so, you know, as we talked about this over this, you know, during the discussions and some of the Tuesday morning meditations, of course, the topic starts to evolve and we have a deeper inroads into how to approach it. Because tonight I'd like to talk about, I'm titling this talk, A Paradigm Shift Around the Worldly Winds. So first, we'll talk about them from the kind of normal paradigm of me trying to work with things as a human level. You know, working with our grief, working with our minds. And then in the second part of the talk, we'll shift into this paradigm shift to really understand this fundamental changing of our perspective. And actually to honor this season, we'll bring upon some Christian mystic teachings and see how that also resonates with our Dharma practice. So reflecting on this sutta, the failings of the world, the worldly winds, it almost seems like something was lost in translation or maybe edited out over these 2,600 years, because it almost seems like this teaching points toward an inner teaching or a secret teaching that's not so apparent as we read the sutta. Because for those of you who had a chance to read it or attended the talk 2 weeks ago, really we look at the difference between the run-of-the-mill person and the well-taught person. And it's, you know, that simple not welcoming or chasing after the pleasure side, not avoiding and rebelling against the pain side. But the Buddha in this sutta doesn't really say how to do that. He doesn't explain how to do it. It's almost he just presents it. Just notice if you're kind of a run-in-the-mill person, you're going to be really buffeted by these winds. If you're more practiced, you can meet them with a quality of grace, a quality of skillfulness, or a freedom from those winds. And so it seemed like there was something that perhaps was the early monks and nuns who decided to write out these suttas and to maintain them for our use today. There's something about this profound shift of paradigm, which I can sense is part of what the Buddha was speaking toward. Because if we take it right now, that sense of, okay, here's the ideal way, the right way to be with these, and here's the wrong way, if you will, in a very, you know, simplistic way. You know, if your mind is at all like mine, it's easy to adopt that as an ideal. Okay, I should be like this when pain arises, when gain a lot rises, from pleasure and pain, you know, fame, disrepute, praise and blame, I should fit myself into that place. So I can force myself into that idea, that ideal that I've created from hearing this sutta and trying to follow the teachings of the Buddha. And in the meantime, we have the tendency to ignore, to repress our true reactions to those winds. Because of course, as human beings, we have strong preferences. You know, does anyone prefer pain versus gain? Does anyone prefer, you know, loss? Prefer being a disrepute or being blamed? You know, of course, we much prefer gain, pleasure, fame, and praise. We sometimes really long for that, crave that. And of course, we do better in our lives when we have more of those positive ones. So, again, as the talk unfolds, we'll shift to talk about this paradigm shift and how to work within, and also how to work within our normal paradigm, or at least modifying our normal paradigm. Because how can we, given just the normal way we approach things, you know, we experience loss, we experience pain, how can we meet that in a skillful way? To speak about that first. So basically, we learn how to hold the pleasure side of things more lightly, without such a grip, without such a clinging quality. We also learn not to be so contracted on the pain side, not to be so overwhelmed by that. So with the pleasure side of things, you know, we again appreciate and long for this side of the winds, longing for that praise, longing for that pleasure. And yet we realize, especially as our eyes open more and more to our practice, we start to realize that even those pleasure side of things also holds a quality of suffering. They carry suffering with them. Especially pleasure side, it can lead to a quality of defending it, protecting it. It can turn into pain. We worry about losing what we've gained. We worry about losing praise and being blamed. We worry about losing our fame, losing our sense of reputation and having perception turning against us as we experience disrepute. Because all these are impermanent. They're subject to change. They arise and they pass away. And so with the pleasure side of it, you know, a simple way is to just remind ourselves as we're feeling those worldly winds in our favor, to just realize, okay, this too is impermanent. This too will pass. Perhaps I remember reading that the Caesars in ancient Rome would have someone riding next to them in the chariot and everyone's cheering them and just proclaiming how great they are to say, you know, this too will pass. This too, don't let this go to your head, basically. And so giving that little bit of perspective, a little bit of that cooling of that complete loss of perspective. Because anytime that there's praise, at some point there will also be blame. With gain, there will also be loss. To start to see this, the danger of clinging and craving to something which is fleeting, even something that's very pleasant. Then, of course, with the pain side of things, you know, a way we can work with our normal kind of skillful means, you know, looking at skillful means now, and then we'll talk to this deeper paradigm shift in a little bit. One way is to work with the brightening of the mind, the brightening of the mind approach. Especially when these things are very gripping, very devastating, when we lose a loved one, when we experience a very sensitive area that we're so, you know, sensitive to criticism around, to blame around. You know, how do we start to brighten the mind? Because our minds just tend to collapse around, tend to contract around criticism, around self-blame, around loss. So learning to intentionally, with particular practices, noticing the good, noticing what is actually right and good in this moment, actually calling our attention to that. And this is often hard because we have this almost a moth to the flames, moving toward what's painful, what's difficult. Things like practicing generosity, practicing gratitude, reflecting on the good that you do. Remember hearing a story from Joseph Goldstein that he was practicing and having his mind become, you know, heavy and kind of contracted. His teacher saw this and wanted to help to brighten his mind, basically. And the teacher said, okay, go to your room, go to your place you're staying and reflect on your ethical conduct. Right? So the intention behind the teacher was to reflect on how ethical he was and how kind he was and how based on harm. But as probably many of us, we would have reflected on all the things, all the harm we do cause and all the guilt and all the shame around it. So it kind of backfired until the teacher caught on and was able to reshift that. But we do have such a tendency to focus on what's wrong. You know, so bringing a very concrete practice, a specific practice around to overcome our natural way of glossing over or not noticing what's pleasant. Could be as simple as before you go to bed, reflect on three things that you're grateful for. Even writing them out brings a quality of specificness, a quality of making it much more concrete. So then we can let that in. You know, as we start our meditations, going through five things we might be grateful for. So many different ways you can follow some of the practices that Tori spoke about in the ritual month that we did a few months ago. And of course, with the pain side, as some of the questions brought out, the need for compassion, to bring compassion to our experience, especially these painful aspects. Because unfortunately, I've noticed that sometimes Dharma practice has this effect of making us less compassionate. It's kind of a strange thing to say, but sometimes we become less compassionate for ourselves because we have these ideas of how I should be as a spiritual practitioner, as a Dharma practitioner, of how we should be and shouldn't be. And we're not able to meet our suffering because it doesn't fit into that image. So we choose our image over the reality of our experience. Remember, compassion has this turning toward meeting what's here, meeting the suffering that's here, meeting without resistance, without trying to, really not trying to even fix it or change it, but just to make that contact. And then once that contact is made, when you're really actually connecting with it deeply, then asking that which is suffering, what is needed. What is needed right here? So this sutta, the worldly winds, I think we can misinterpret it as setting up this dynamic of how we think we should be and denying how we actually are. You know, I should be unaffected by the pleasures of life. I should be unaffected by the pains of life. I think this is not so realistic as human beings. Remember the two wings of the Dharma and how they bring both wisdom and compassion are really one and the same and so essential to our practice is flourishing. And one comment that I heard during this week was around how intense loss, deep loss of a loved one has the effect of opening our hearts in unexpected ways, helps us shift to a different perspective and allows our contracted heart, even in the midst of pain, somehow we let go, something lets go of us. And in this place, there's a natural joy that starts to arise. It's almost like the pain of that loss tenderizes our heart. And being surprised by how much joy is actually present. So Ajahn Chah has this famous quote, of two kinds of suffering. There are two kinds of suffering. The suffering which leads to more suffering and the suffering which leads to the end of suffering. The first is the pain of grasping after fleeting pleasures and aversion for the unpleasant, the continued struggle of most people day after day. This is our normal way of relating to these eight worldly winds. The second is the suffering, which comes when you allow yourself to feel fully the constant change of experience, pleasure, pain, joy, anger, without fear or withdrawal. The suffering of our experience leads to inner fearlessness and peace. So this is this process of really meeting, because all these eight winds represent forms of suffering. There's the obvious one of the pain side, but there's also the perhaps hidden pain at the pleasure side of things. As one person brought up last week, just starting to realize that, to see that directly, that each of these have their own quality of suffering in them. And there's a sense of disillusionment that starts to arise from that. But what am I supposed to do? I have pain whichever way I turn. Yeah, this is part of that sobering, that waking up from the illusion, the disillusionment of our normal way of being in the world, our normal chasing after sense pleasure and avoiding pain, of seeking after the praise and the success and the gain, to avoiding the blame, avoiding the shame, the loss. So how can we meet this? So part of it is, again, learning when to meet it with compassion, learning to meet it with the sense of brightening the mind, learning to cool our, maybe just sober ourselves a little bit about how long this pleasure side will last. But I think, as I hinted at the beginning of this talk, there's this inner or secret part of this teaching that the Buddha is pointing toward. And this is this paradigm shift, this shift, fundamental shift of perspective. Now, what do I mean by this paradigm shift? I was reflecting on physics of all things and how our understanding of physics has really changed over the many years. That the Newtonian physics, you know, there's a sense of gravity, there's a sense of force, and that all seemed to make complete sense. Then Einstein comes around and adds this other element of time. And so suddenly everything's kind of turned on its head. Suddenly there's a whole different way that the world is seen, the world is experienced. And then quantum physics arrives. And there's this whole other way of seeing it. As I saw online, here's the problem between relativity and quantum mechanics are fundamentally different theories. They have different formulations. It's not just a matter of scientific terminology. It's a clash of genuinely incompatible descriptions of reality. Right? Different descriptions of reality. This is the paradigm shift. So from one paradigm, our normal paradigm of self and other, of separation, the worldly winds have a whole different level of being perceived and experienced. They really buffet us. We really do seek after the pleasure. We really welcome it. We want more and more of that side of it. While the pain side of it, we're always avoiding, we're rebelling against that. This makes complete sense within that worldview, within that set of equations and formulations that has that sense of self as its fundamental theorem, its fundamental premise. So then this paradigm shift that allows these worldly winds to suddenly become transformed into not something that buffets us, but actually something that can move through us. Let's speak about that now. And to honor, you know, partly to honor the season, you know, Christmas is on Saturday, to also honor the mystic aspect of Christianity and how that interfaces with the Dharma. I want to speak a little bit about the Gospel of Thomas. So this is one of the Gnostic Gospels. And there's, of course, debate about how much this was Christ or not. But from a Dharmic standpoint, it has a resonance. It has a strong resonance. The mysticism, you know, points toward really this quality of non-dualism, this non-separation, which is a part of Buddhism. It's part of other traditions. And when you start to bring that forth, some of these koans of these suttas, some of these koans of how do you work with the worldly winds and how do you become a well-taught person versus a run-of-the-mill person, start to fall into place because they point toward us, toward that paradigm shift, that shift from Newtonian physics to quantum mechanics. So the first preface, I just pulled out a few of these short sayings from the Gospel of Thomas that Thomas reported, you know, hearing from Jesus. And the first part, the very first sentence is that, and he said, whoever discovers the interpretation of these sayings will not taste death. Okay, so you're talking, quoting Jesus. Whoever discovers the interpretation of these sayings will not taste death. So usually this, we interpret this as everything about the afterlife, about everlasting life, about heaven. But what if it was actually pointing toward something very similar to what the Buddha talked about when he spoke about the deathless? The unconditioned, the unborn. Yes, remembering dependent origination. That's pointing toward that. In that 12-step cycle, he really points to what is the deathless, this quality of releasing that selfing. Because when that self arises, As I remember, after that self, after you're born, next stage is death. Right? So, you know, we can talk about this not in this, I think the physical life and death, of course, has its relevance very strongly so. But I think the PowerPoint is really how it shows up in this moment. How in this moment, there's these constant deaths and constant births in form of mind states, in form of beliefs, in form of opinions, in form of experience. If you really start to step back and see that, well, you saw, okay, I'm really solidly here. You actually see how you're just constantly arising and passing away. You see this cycle of life and death. So whoever discovers the interpretation of these things will not taste death. We'll fall into what is beyond arising and passing away. The unconditioned, nibbana. So I already get a sense of that shift of paradigm. Now, Jesus, you know, only taught for, I think, around 3 years or so before he met his end on the cross. And we often think of him as this very peaceful, you know, peaceful person. But some of the sutta points to a different quality to him. The quality of him being very fiery, very, very passionate, very engaged in pointing out the truth, helping people see things directly. This next one that Jesus said, perhaps people think that I have come to cast peace upon the world. They do not know that I have come to cast conflict upon the earth, fire, sword, and war. That's kind of a wake-up call. Is that really what, you know, that can see how we can easily, you know, discount that. It was maybe what Jesus said. But again, let's look at it as not literal war, not literal fire, but spurting something else, spurting that paradigm. Think of it as he's saying, what I'm here to do is to destroy your paradigm, to allow a deeper, the true paradigm to show itself, to allow you to shift that perspective. Jesus said, I will destroy this house and no one will be able to build it. I will destroy this house and no one will be able to build it. Now that's such an interesting phrasing because as many of you know from the Dhammapada, the verses of the Buddha, there's the house builder sutta, where the Buddha says, seeking but not finding the house builder, I traveled through the round of countless births. Oh, painful is birth ever and again. House builder, you have now been seen. You shall not build the house again. Your rafters have been broken down. Your ridgepole is demolished too. My mind has now attained the unformed nibbana and reached the end of every kind of craving. And the Dhammapada, 153 to 54. So both Jesus and the Buddha are talking about this analogy of this house, this place that we inhabit. You know, another way of talking about this paradigm. This is the paradigm that I inhabit. So from that normal paradigm, again, we have a very different relationship to these eight worldly winds. It makes complete sense to fight against some of them and to grace after other ones. But when we start to go into the fundamental problem of what is this house? What is this paradigm? That's the problem that the Buddha was trying to solve. That's the problem I think that Jesus was trying to solve. I keep trying to say the Jesus because I'm used to saying the Buddha. So sorry. Sorry about the Christians out there. I don't mean any offense. So it's this shift of paradigm, shift of that physics perspective, the way we describe and make sense of the world. Now, this process of shifting paradigms is, I think there's a reason why Jesus spoke of it in such fiery language, because it is this something dissolves, something lets go of us that we've really trusted and built our lives upon. Part of that trust in what we've built upon that, of course, is the cycle of suffering. You know, there's also many good things, of course. There's many good things. So it's not that we lose all good things in our lives, we lose everything. It's more this shift of perspective. It's shifting us right in this moment how we're perceiving life. And the wonderful thing is that the paradigm shift from our normal isolated paradigm of self and other doesn't hold this other paradigm. We just can't perceive it. Well, the paradigm of non-separation, of non-self, of non-duality, it can actually hold duality. It can actually allow it to be seen and fall back into its stillness. But doing this process, and we see this in meditation, when we start to get these inroads into this softening, or as Rodney Smith likes to talk about, that thinning of self, there's often a little bit of disquiet, of dis-ease, because I'm not sure who I am or what I am in that moment. That's house builder starting to fall away. That paradigm starting to shift. And sometimes it has a much more profound shift. It's like there's almost a terrorizes as we see, okay, who am I in this? Until we start to see the deep peace on the other side of that, the deep quality of joy, of freedom on the other side of that. So Jesus said this. He said that those who seek should not stop seeking until they find. When they find, they will be disturbed. When they are disturbed, they will marvel, and they will rule over all. So he's, to me, really describing so much of our meditative practice that we seek, we keep looking and keep seeing with a quality of sincerity, of diligence, practicing, trying to understand our contraction of heart, trying to see where we create that quality of separation, seeing how dukkha arises. And once we start to see that and find that, and we actually understand, okay, really what's asked of us, what's the root cause, what's the paradigm that must be released, what's the house that must be released, we're disturbed, we're like disquieted, like, well, who am I going to be if I'm not in this role of a father, as a teacher, as a husband, as a wife, as a man or as a woman, whatever it might be. There's this shift that we don't know who we are, what we are. And then when we're disturbed, when we start to let that in, then there's a wonder, a marvel that comes. And from that, then there's a sense of non-separation. There's that shift of paradigm. So I hope you start to see that there's this almost no man's land as we go from one paradigm to another. We're kind of in between both of them. And that's often a rough part of our practice, because we're still very much believing in the old paradigm, but we're also seeing the fallacy in it. We see how it doesn't really pay out the way we thought it would. And we haven't fully released into the new paradigm. And as the spiritual practice, as the mature and longtime practitioners know, you can have these openings in some areas of your life. And then you somehow connect with someone else in your life, and you find that you suddenly feel like you've never practiced before, because it throws you back into your contraction. It closes your heart back up. That's why there's this practice of integration, of deepening. So again, the Buddha, I mean, Jesus gave so many clues in this Gospel of Thomas. Here's the next one about what this paradigm shift is like. So Jesus said to his disciples, compare me to something and tell me what I am like. Compare me to something and tell me what I am like. So Simon Peter said to him, you're like a just angel. Matthew said to him, you are like a wise philosopher. Thomas said to him, teacher, my mouth is utterly unable to say what you are like. Teacher, my mouth is utterly unable to say what you are like. Right? Pointing toward how words cannot go this, where this is going. I can't describe that paradigm because it's outside of thought, outside of word, outside of concept. And Jesus replied to Thomas, I am not your teacher because you have drunk. You have become intoxicated from the bubbling spring that I have tended. And he took him and withdrew and spoke three sayings to him. And when Thomas came back to his friends, they asked him, what did Jesus say to you? And Thomas said to them, if I tell you one of the sayings he spoke to me, you will pick up rocks and stone me, and fire will come from the rocks and devour you. What did Jesus say to Thomas? He's pointing in this, I think, if Thomas had quoted, he knew, realized that it would be so easy to misunderstand. Because Thomas had, you know, had this deep awakening, a deep understanding of what Jesus was speaking of. And he's found words cannot come from that place. And Jesus was able to meet him from that, from his own stillness, meaning Thomas's stillness. And coming back into our normal paradigm, then it's so disruptive. It has that. The stones being thrown at you, and the fire from the rocks to devour you. It shakes the other people's paradigm. This is really this paradigm shift, this paradigm shift. So you start to get a sense of how these worldly winds, we have a very different relationship to them as we step into this paradigm, this shift of paradigm. And the second to last one I'm going to share from this one, this Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel according to Thomas, is Jesus said to them, when you make the two into one, and when you make the inner like the outer, and the outer like the inner, and the upper like the lower, and when you make male and female into a single one, so that the male will not be male, nor the female be female, when you make eyes in place of an eye, a hand in place of a hand, a foot in place of a foot, an image in place of an image, then you will enter. Then we enter the domain. We enter this paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. Holding these opposites, things we keep so separate, and see how they actually, that paradigm shift, that separation falls away. It's a paradigm shift, seeing that praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain. Suddenly that makes sense, that this is how we can meet both of them, by completely shifting that paradigm. So I know this is kind of going pretty far out there and mixing religions, but I feel strongly that, you know, the truth is not just a Buddhist truth, it's not just a Christian truth, or a Jewish truth, or Islam truth, or Hindu truth, or any religion. They all are pointing to some essence. They're all like these treasure maps that we can learn to hear and see. And to follow. And they come down to really clearing our eyes so we can see things how they actually are. And the final saying, Jesus said that you see the sliver in your friend's eye, but you don't see this timber in your own eye. When you take the timber out of your own eye, you will see well enough to remove the sliver from your friend's eye. You know, so we see those worldly winds and we see that suffering, but we don't really see the suffering. We see the conditional suffering. Oh, I lost something. I gained something. I was praised. I was blamed. I was famous. And then I was shamed. I had pleasure. Then I have pain. That's like that little sliver that catches our eye, but we often don't see the big timber, the big piece of wood that's really distorting the very way we see, that's holding in us in our normal paradigm. So how do we practice with that? How do we allow that to come forth? That's the mystery. So the homework, let's speak about that for a moment to kind of give us the conclusion on the talk. And also an invitation for practicing. So when the worldly winds blow, practice this paradigm shift. You know, realize that a worldly wind hits you, whether it's the pleasure side or the painful side. You're going to be preconditioned to fix it, to meet it in a certain way. You're going to load it with your normal paradigm. So relax those normal reactions and tendencies. Practice releasing your history, releasing all that has come before, releasing the creation of the story of you within this worldly wind, releasing the story of you within this worldly wind. I have lost this. I have gained this. I am praised. I am blamed. But instead of adopting a new paradigm or your idea of a new paradigm, okay, here's the practice. Try allowing stillness and silence to come to the forefront. Okay, try allowing stillness and silence to come to the forefront, to allow that, if you, even right now as we're listening, as you're in your room, if you relax the story, there's something else that starts to suddenly rush to the foreground. And staying with the unknown of that, the mystery of that stillness, and allowing yourself to be less defined, less established in that moment. And inviting the heart to open in a kind of a boundlessness, a boundless way in the midst of this worldly wind. So the worldly winds help us, that normal pain that we usually struggle so much with, start to transform that as this impetus, this energy to turn toward this different paradigm, really a paradigm without paradigms. All right, let's just sit quietly for a few moments, and then there are some space for any questions or comments or sharing there might be. The shift to paradigm sometimes seems so elusive and so far away. It's elusive because it's always here. It's here right now. If we just allow ourselves to see it, to allow it to come forth. All right, so we have space for some questions or comments, or you know, if there's anything that's confusing about this talk, please let's bring it forth. Let's explore together. Are anyone here in the room? Yeah, Cubba, would you mind coming over to the...
So, Tim, I really appreciated the boundless, spacious quality that you were describing. And I don't want to narrow the channel too much here, but the word that was coming to me was the word outcome and wondering if as a, like a guidepost, when I'm stuck in those two or clinging to one, or if I can just say to myself, maybe like, oh, outcome. I think there should be a certain outcome here to get back to the.
So when you say outcome, to kind of call your attention to the kind of the perspective or the paradigm that you're meeting that with, that I'm really focused on the outcome of that moment.
Yes.
It sounds like identifying, okay, here's that shape of that suffering. Here's the particular way I'm contracting. And then, from by seeing it, then you're able to release it.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
Yes. Like I'm clinging because I think you should have done that, or I should be doing this. And now I'm immediately in a future or a past or.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I often, you know, that kind of a question, and Rodney would often talk about it, is this vertical question that kind of brings us right into this, you know, from the vertical versus the horizontal with the normal time focus, outcome focus, and to bring us right into the present moment. Excuse me. And I think we can use the questions two ways. Let's see, I'll switch back. So people can see me if they like. Sorry, navigating this. So the question of the outcome is like the question, like the Buddha said, I teach one thing, suffering or the end of suffering. So I think it's so helpful to be able to specifically see that nature of that suffering. And something like the word outcome, you know, we're not conscious of that, you know, of course drives us. Okay, I want this certain outcome. I want more of this or less of that. And so I think it's a beautiful way of kind of summing up the process that we're engaged in, the process of our suffering, to kind of call attention to it. And if we can call attention to it and see it, that's the magical thing about our practice. Often just seeing it clearly and directly is enough. That moment of clear seeing can be very transformational. And so I think it's helpful to play with, to see when that's really a fresh approach. Other times it might be, you know, a word that calls forth the end of suffering. You know, maybe like love or a sense of surrender or a sense of openness. And just seeing, you know, the most important thing, Kaban, and for everyone, is to notice what word or phrase really connects and allows you to transform that moment of contraction. Sometimes it's by calling forth the suffering. Sometimes by calling forth the release of that suffering. Yeah. Yeah. And so you get that way, become more and more empowered in your practice. Yeah. So you see for yourself, oh yeah, this leads to the release of my suffering. And then you know that more and more. Yeah. That's the heart opening. Thank you, Kappa. All right, how about back here on the root world of Zoom? Anyone have anything like to share? All right, Kathy, go ahead.
Thank you, Tim, first of all. Fascinating, and I'm trying not to engage my mind here too much, but very interesting and deep talk, it seems like it might point away from sort of the mundane. I'm wondering how to apply this to the mundane activities of life. I mean, I kind of know this, I guess, but not really. I just maybe you could say something about that. But how going forward now, going out to make a meal or do the dishes, how this is going to come into play?
Sure. So, like, how to bring this in, doing the dishes or cleaning the house or mailing the letters, whatever it might be. Yeah, absolutely. So the sense of the paradigm shift, sometimes we talk about it in very, you know, dramatic ways and very powerful ways. And sometimes these big, you know, big losses help us to see that more clearly, because we just, like, the dukkha is too much to try to hold in a contracted way, and we have to shift to something else. You know, our heart just naturally goes that way. But this, because it's a shift of perspective, it's actually available in very simple things and very mundane things. And that has the power of really transforming even the ordinary into something that feels profound, that feels sacred. And in fact, sometimes it's easier when it's just a mundane thing, because it doesn't carry it the same charge. We're not so much, you know, on the ropes trying to navigate this worldly wind. It's like, oh, you know, I just, you know, I forgot, I missed this grease spot in the back of the plate. Okay, so you can feel that, you know, the irritation or whatever might come up around that. And right there, you can practice, you know, as Kubba beautifully shared, is having that a word that may really call this all forth to you. You know, something that calls forth, you know, the particular pattern of dukkha-izing, I made up a word just there, creating suffering right there, or the sense of selfing around that. You know, or you could something that sees the release of that. And you may have to play to find what's the right word that connects with that. And then what I like to do is, like, if I'm doing something, you know, going back to like the intro class, when those who've gone through it with Rodney or Tori or myself, we often give those meditative markers. Because so often we're doing stuff and we're just, our mind's doing one thing, our body's doing another thing. We just bring those things together, so our mind is actually with what we're actually doing. Not in a forced way, but in a way of really celebrating that experience. Then we start to get that sense of the sacred within it.
Thank you, Tim. Great.
Yeah, I think I don't know if I've quite expressed around this that what feels complete around it to me anyway. Maybe it's complete to you. I think for myself, often what happens is maybe I'm meditating, or maybe there's this deeper opening, and then from that perspective, I practice it in really small ways, like talking to a loved one, taking a walk, doing a household chore. It's almost like that perspective arises for whatever reason. And then from that perspective, I practice living. I practice being in the world. Because sometimes it's hard when you're trying to do the dishes. You just kind of go in this. It's hard to force this. But when it naturally arises, okay, what does it feel like to be in the world from this perspective? All right, thank you, Kathy. Let's see, I thought I saw another hand up. Do you still want to talk, Ron, or are you done, or decided not to?
Yeah, I can. I just want to thank you for this talk. I thought it was wonderful, and it touched on a lot of the thoughts I have, and I'm very interested in this, and where the teachings came to Jesus and followed through the Jewish temples or what, you know, but it's and just the other part, the whole thing of just being with the worldly winds and just kind of taking that space. I really like the whole thing, how it seems to bring me into the present more and more, just broadens that sense of being in the present. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Ron. Yeah, and that sense of being brought into the present, that whatever teaching it is, or wherever tradition it is, when it brings you into the present, you know, you can trust that that's good teaching. That brings you into it. And, you know, that's the part that I wanted to really highlight, that discernment of noticing, oh, I've arrived. I'm actually inhabiting this present moment. And to really honor that, you know, to follow that. So thank you, Ron. Anyone here in the room like to share anything? All right, let's go with Cheryl, and then we'll come to Iris.
What you talked about with paradigm shift, I really appreciate it. Last night, I've been having trouble sleeping lately. I'm changing my meds and stuff. So I'm awake in the middle of the night, and, you know, nothing like being awake in the middle of the night and just having everything come up. And what I'm doing is I'm noticing, first of all, just how in 1 minute I'm like, I'm in panic mode. And then the next minute I'm like, okay, you know, I'm fine. I can lay here. I can feel my body touching the bed. But the other thing that I'm doing is I'm saying metta. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I start saying metta, you know, may I be safe and protected, maybe, it's amazing how well it calms me down and, mm-hmm. and, you know, puts me in that still place that I really want to be in, you know, get out of that panic mode. You know, it's like, oh, I'm trying to get away from panic and, you know, I'm trying to get out of pain and get into pleasure here, but I think it's much more subtle than that. So I appreciate your talk about paradigm shift here, because it really is. It's totally it. I mean, you know, just get out of that one place where I feel all contracted, where I feel like, you know, the world is caving in around me and
wonderful. Thank you, Cheryl. Yeah, that sense of doing metta when we're having that, you know, especially in the middle of the night when we're, you know, our defenses are down, we're tired, but our mind is really active and there's all these emotions and thoughts just racing through us. Yeah, to practice metta. And again, you know, I've kind of strung between a number of people is you see the cause and effect. It's like you start to discern, oh, this action, this means actually is beneficial. It actually shifts this mind state, shifts this place I have been in into a different place. You know, that's the essence of wise action, is having to be able to see clearly what action actually leads to less suffering. What action allows me to release the suffering that's present? What's action allows this peace, this ease that's here to deepen? And so you see that with metta. You know, certainly metta, you know, the Buddha would give that as an antidote when people were really afraid and terrified of the forest or of their minds, as a way of really calming things, of shifting that intentionality from our worry, our panic, into may I be safe, may I be peaceful. Yeah, thank you, Cheryl. All right, Iris, would you like to go?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Tim. I am in mind of the comment that you made a few weeks ago, I think at the board meeting, about the worldly winds and when one comes upon you, you think to yourself, well, the opposite one's going to come, you know, any time now, which of course speaks to impermanence and the changing nature. And so, you know, in my thinking about that and holding that, because that was very resonant for me, I see how I form, how my identity forms around any of those worldly winds, and whether it's the quote unquote positive ones or not, that tightening, that forming is, you know, I just feel the suffering inherent in that identifying. And you know, so seeing that and trying, you know, to open, allowing some openness and releasing, thinking, you know, oh, I've blown it, or no, I've done a great job. Either one of those is a problem. And so releasing both of those leads to a lot more ease in my body and mind.
Yes, thank you, Iris. Yeah, exactly. That sense of noticing the identity that arises, the sense, the selfing that arises in relationship to it. Because these worldly winds are really powerful ways that the sense of self arises. You know, we feel really, I really know who I am when I'm blamed, when I feel who I am when I'm praised. They're so strong. And that's that, you know, going back to the seeing clearly is seeing that, okay, it's not the fact that I'm being blamed. It's not the fact that I'm not being praised. It's the issue, the real course, really the real source of the suffering is that identification. You know, that identifying around that. Without that identifying piece there, you know, then, oh, there's praise. Thank you. There's blame. Okay. Thank you. You know, we can meet both of them equally, you know, gain, loss. We hold them equally. We also can hold that perspective that, yeah, who knows how this will turn out? You know, maybe this is actually a good thing that I lost this. Maybe it's a good thing that there was this sense of shame so I can really learn about myself in a different way. Mm-hmm. And that's the underlying piece that, you know, I think is, that's why I think it's pretty obvious, but that tends to be the focus of all my own Dharma practice and focus of so much of my teaching is, where is that identification? How do we meet that? How do we understand it? How do we become free of that? And that's the fundamental piece that we're trying to learn as Dharma practitioners.
Thank you.
Thank you, Iris. All right, anyone back here in the room? All right, Beth, would you like to go ahead?
Yeah, thank you. Just wanted to share a little insight that I had this week in thinking through the worldly winds. I am a parent of a six-year-old, so there are lots of worldly winds swirling around our house at all times. There's loads of pain and pleasure and gain and loss. And I've found it so interesting, especially in light of what you were saying about really fully feeling and feeling fully without fear or withdrawal, and seeing that in my daughter's reactions to everything, like every small slight or great excitement, and learning what it looks like without clinging. And learning what it looks like when you're not thinking about something lasting forever. And it's just been really instructive to me to see from a sort of an older and wiser perspective, but also to see the experience of a young mind and this sort of like less conditioned experience of these winds. And it's, you know, it's been really eye-opening to me to sort of watch with that perspective.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, Beth. I think with your children, they tend to feel things, especially with that younger age, that six-year-old perspective. They just feel things very fully without, you know, a lot of self-consciousness, without a lot of, you know, how am I being perceived. They just feel it fully. And then there's in that full feeling, there's the release of it. And so much as adults, we kind of learned, okay, am I feeling appropriately in this situation? What are people thinking about me? That so much comes to the forefront and we become a little stiff in our reactions. Even while we grow, you know, the wisdom grows around seeing those worldly winds and our Dharma practice. So that sounds like that's a lovely integration to bring what you're learning in your own practice and seeing how this arises in your daughter. And you're also teaching her too, how to hold them lightly, you know, how to hold them with a sense of grace that, yeah, of course this will not last forever. And it's wonderful that it's here. And it's so sad that it's gone. And now there's something else is arising. And it's, yeah, so that we're certainly profound teachers for our children, but they are also profound teachers for ourselves, not only in how they are in the world, but also they show us our own edges. They all show us like, oh, I want to cling a little bit more than they're willing to cling. And, you know, how I'm bringing my own, how I was parented, how I was conditioned. And you start to really transform that, you know, so the child can really have their own life and you heal those parts in yourself. So thank you for sharing that. That's such a nice integration of practice into life. All right, anyone else like to share anything? All right, Bob, go ahead.
Hi, Tim. Hi, everybody. Tim, I was interested in the reference to the Gospel of Thomas, and I wondered if you could kind of summarize your link up to that one more time in terms of paradigms. I wasn't completely clear on how you were linking the two.
Sure, how is linking a paradigm shift with the sayings from the Gospel of Thomas?
Yeah, in the worldly winds.
All right, so summarize the whole the whole talk. That's great. No, I mean,
we only got to Thomas toward the end, I think. But I was just trying to follow the.
Sure. Let me see if I can sum that up, you know, in a clear way, and then help me if I'm not clear enough there. Yeah. So normally, I mean, the basic premise of the talk was that we have a kind of a set way that we are in the world, a set paradigm. And with those paradigms, just like a, you know, a set of physics equations or ways of framing the world, it has its own logic, its own rules. Right? And within that rules, the worldly winds have a certain impact on us, that we really care about gain, we care about loss, we care about all of these. They really mean a lot to us. It really shapes, in some ways, who we are in the moment. We experience praise, we experience blame, it really coalesces. That's part of that whole logic, that whole set of rules, of premises that paradigm is shifted on. And the Buddha and also Jesus, as I was speaking to in this Gospel According to Thomas, points to how that paradigm, some, you know, there's a more of a fiery way that Jesus was talking about. We can really see through it. We can almost like set fire to it, so we burn through it. And in that burning through, you know, there's this, you know, we're not sure who we are, what we are, but then there's also this sense of duality that falls away, a sense of, you know, self and other, upper and lower, male, female, all those things start to fall away because we're opening to a very different paradigm. And, you know, like with Thomas, when he was saying, what is, you know, who am I? What am I like to Jesus? How he had no words. I could not say anything that there's no, my mouth is, let's see, where was that section? My teacher, my mouth is utterly unable to say what you're like. And so point, you know, using those sayings from the Gospel According to Thomas as way of kind of showing what that experience is like from that paradigm shift. And from that paradigm shift, you hopefully got to start to get a sense of how the worldly winds are experienced very differently. Because the fundamental part of that paradigm shift is that central aspect, central pivot of self falls away. And in that falling away, the worldly winds don't have that same vortex to center around. And then the sutta where he says, okay, the well-taught person doesn't rebel against the unpleasant, doesn't chase, welcome the pleasant. Does that help? Does that make sense? Or well, how else can I help clarify that?
Is it falling away from a sort of paradigm of duality, sort of? Like it's this or that, it's praise or blame, pain or loss, or gain, or gain or loss. Is it sort of, are you suggesting sort of a middle way, for lack of a better expression, where you're not solely seeing one or the other? Because I can relate to that. I mean, I tend to see them as continua, I think, and dimensions of each other, kind of.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's a way we can play with it, is seeing how they are kind of part of a continuum. You know, we can go, you know, it's part of this spectrum. But again, we're talking about like non-duality. It's like duality is really dependent upon the sense of Tim, the sense of Bob seeing the duality. you know, just by looking out and seeing that there's two, we're already right there, you know, in the sense of duality. So somehow if we shifted that perspective of, just didn't make sense to say, okay, there's me having this experience. They're just the experience arising. That's that shift of paradigm. So the sense of seeing the continuum, that's still part of that old paradigm, but it can be a skillful way to use that old paradigm. And that's something I wanted to say in the talk that I didn't, is to start to notice, you know, in our lives, that sometimes it's really appropriate for us to okay, I'm going to just work with this as skillfully as I can. I'm going to, you know, meet myself with compassion. I'm going to brighten my mind. I'm going to, you know, see this as a continuum, just to help the mind start to relax, to help me deal with these pulls and pushes, these losses that we experience. You know, this would be so gripping. And it allows us to somehow, helps us start to ground, help us to find a place of footing in the midst of this life. And sometimes there can be a very different shift, a paradigm shift that transforms the very assumptions of self and other. So both are helpful, both are appropriate, and both are needed.
Thanks, that helps.
All right, thank you, Bob. All right, we have time maybe for one more. If there's anything out in the physical room or Zoom room. All right, looks like we've said all that needs to be said tonight, which is, you know, thank you for all your sharing and your engagement. And, you know, if you celebrate Christmas, have a wonderful holiday. And if you don't, then also have a wonderful week. And next week, we'll have a chance to engage in this topic some more to see, you know, the homework, it's a bit, I don't want to say advanced, but it's definitely pointing to a different way. And it's a different way of practicing, you know, around that stillness and that silence. Think of it as not trying to get someplace, but more allow something that's already there to arise. Something that's already there, allow that to arise. What needs to be released to allow that to arise. And play with that. Play with that with the small gains and losses, you know, like Beth was speaking of, the daily ones that come. You know, if big ones arise, you can practice in that way. And just see, is there an access to some fundamental shift of paradigm? The next week, you have a chance to share that with each other, and we'll do a recap talk and maybe expand upon this. All right, so have a wonderful evening, and thank you for your support of Sims and of the teachers, and you're welcome to say goodbye if you like.